A reassurance we often need to give to hurt and damaged people, non-believers, very often, is that there is a God. And there is a God who is right and just. And what that adds up to at the end of the day is whatever experience they've been through in life that's been hard or harsh, there ain't nobody going to get away with nothing. Because there is a God. And at the end of the day, he is a God of justice. And that reassurance helps them very often to make sense of the confusing situation they've got. Now, of course, God's justice can be corrective. And that's what we read about in Daniel chapter 4, where King Nebuchadnezzar is dealt with by God for his injustice in the way that he governs and his rebellion against God, his arrogance. But now we're in chapter 5. And there, the justice that comes to that person from God is not corrective, but retributive. Justice being done because justice is right and needs to be done. And here in chapter 5 of Daniel, we see that happening. We see that happening to somebody who raises their fist against God and makes much of themselves in his place. And all that we read about in Daniel chapter 5 is about Babylon's last night. Babylon. Byword for bad government, brutality, authoritarian rule in rebellion against God, oppressing the people of God. The byword for that, Babylon is about to fall to the Persians under King Cyrus. Now, looking through these chapters of Daniel, the section that's in Aramaic, the panel of the book that's set apart in that way, we've noticed how Chapter 2 is balanced by chapter 7, and chapter 3 reflects chapter 6, and chapter 4 reflects chapter 5. This chapter then corresponds to Daniel 4, where there had been another king, humbled Nebuchadnezzar, but God restored his power. Not so with this king, Belshazzar, in this chapter, who saw the writing on the wall. Do you remember that story? Both chapter 4 and chapter 5, at the centre of that sort of panel, it's all reflected, one chapter reflecting one further on, like a mirror image of one that's gone before. These chapters 4 and 5 are at the centre, the very centre of that panel in the book. And they're both about proud human kings who are judged for their behaviour and for the rebellion against God by God himself. But the contrast in these two chapters, chapter 4 and 5, between these two kings, one experiences the corrective judgment of God and turns back, and his rule is restored, and he's a great king. And the king in this chapter, chapter 5, King Belshazzar, who does not turn back to God, and who comes to a sticky end on Babylon's last night. And again, the foreign captive Daniel comes in and does what the king's experts couldn't do, of whom the king had been very proud, but they just weren't capable. And the purpose? Not to highlight Daniel's ability, but to highlight the God of Israel and his justice of character, and it's being done to encourage the oppressed, the captives who'd been taken away to Babylon, and those who are oppressed amongst the people of God by bad rulers in the ages to come, because this theme comes up again in the book of Revelation, to encourage Christians under Roman domination in their time. So, first of all then, the context of chapter 5 of Daniel, it's the last night of Babylon. Babylon is about to fall to the Persians, 539 BC. Here's the history, here's how it's gone. God's kingdom was divided into north and south in 922 BC. You get the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah, including Jerusalem. And the northern kingdom fell to Assyria, the Assyrian Empire, in 722 BC. And then the southern kingdom of Judah, with Jerusalem, falls to Babylon in 587 BC. The people go off into exile, and Daniel goes off into exile with his friends, the young people, the best of the young people, the best of the crop of Israel and Jerusalem, of Judah and Jerusalem. They're all taken off to exile in Babylon, 587 BC. Now that exile officially ends, as the prophets Jeremiah and Isaiah prophesied, it officially ends in 539 BC when Cyrus the Persian defeats the Babylon Empire. And this chapter then happens on the last night of Babylon in 539 BC, at least 2 decades after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. And the fall of Babylon is a huge thing in the ancient Near East's history. Much is made of the causes and the events, and not a huge deal is made of it in Daniel 5. You only get to know about it when you get to the end. And it's really about the causes of it, not the events. All it says in Daniel 5 is verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain, and Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. You see, there's hope there. Okay, the narrator is not at all interested then in how this happened. He's totally focused on the why of what happened. And it's about the theological understanding of this historical event. The Bible sees God as active in the events of human history. Now, Belshazzar is no great shakes. In terms of the rest of ancient Near Eastern history, we hear a lot about Nebuchadnezzar. He was a great king. We didn't know anything about Belshazzar outside the Book of Daniel until the 19th century, when some texts were discovered that shared he was a co-regent, never actually the king. Nebuchadnezzar was king up until 562 BC. He was succeeded by his son, Amel-Marduk, who reigned from 562 to 560 BC, and he was succeeded by Nebuchadnezzar's brother-in-law, Nergal-Sarnessar. That was 560 to 556 BC. And he was succeeded by Nebuchadnezzar's nephew, his son, Labashi-Marduk. And then there was a revolt in 556 that overthrew him. He was usurped by a guy called Nabonidus. But Nabonidus was missing a lot of the time. There's a suggestion that he had some sort of mental illness as well. There was this revolt then in 556 that overthrew him. In came Nabonidus, but he didn't rule very much. He was not there. And his son Belshazzar, that's the guy we've got, was therefore his co-regent over Babylon in its day of decline. Chapter 5 repeatedly refers to Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar as father and son. Literally, they are not. Now, in Semitic languages, the successor would be called son, even if he's an illegitimate successor, which Belshazzar was. But this is repeated and repeated by the narrator, and it's key to the narrator's purpose. He's a usurper, you see. Well, there's a little bit about the background to Babylon's last night and the background to what's happening in this account in chapter 5. What happens in chapter 5? Firstly, drinking from the golden vessels of the temple in Jerusalem, verses 1 to 4. And this really highlights the character of the guy and the reason that God is absolutely fed up with his regime and with this man. They're drinking from the golden vessels. Verse 1 gives us no date or explanation of Belshazzar. All we know about him is he made a great feast. No great shakes. It mirrors the language of chapter 3, verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. Same words, different king. One made a great statue, this one made a great feast. Extravagant statue, extravagant feast. It invites you to compare these two kings, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Compare and contrast. And what Belshazzar does is so egregious because he's the son of King Nebuchadnezzar. Should have known better. Well, verses 2 to 3 then focus on the vessels of gold, which King Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the Jerusalem temple. See chapter 1. And what did King Nebuchadnezzar do with those vessels? He put them into the temple of his God in Babylon. He shows them that much respect. They are sacred things. They're put into his sacred place. Sacred objects are put in a sacred place, the sacred place of his God, we're told. Temple's gone and destroyed with the rest of Jerusalem, but the temple vessels are showed the respect of being safely tucked up away in exile in Babylon, and God promised through Jeremiah that he will return those vessels, same vessels, to his temple in Jerusalem. There's a great stress in these verses on whose these vessels are. Taken out of the temple in Jerusalem, out of the house of God, repeated in verses 2 and 3, out of the house of God. Emphasis is on these vessels. They don't belong to Nebuchadnezzar. They don't belong to Marduk, Nebuchadnezzar's god, nor Belshazzar, but they're the vessels from the Jerusalem temple. And by the way, that's the house of God. And by the way, the house of God is in Jerusalem. That's being emphasized and emphasized. The vessels to Belshazzar, the king in this chapter, are the tangible representations of King Nebuchadnezzar's defeat of the God of Israel. And Belshazzar is demonstrating the control he has over the items that are the symbol of his father Nebuchadnezzar's great victory. He's asserting himself over those things, showing himself up to be marvellous chap, powerful, mighty. And what that provokes, next of all, in verses 5 to 8, is this writing on the wall. The writing's on the wall. Belshazzar has taken God's vessels from God's temple in God's city, Jerusalem, and he hasn't honoured them the way that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, did. He's using them for common, ordinary uses, drinking from them in his big old feast. And now we get writing on the wall, verses 5 to 8. This hand appears, and it's a very spooky scene. A disembodied hand. That's the first thing that's emphasized. And then in the language of the text, there's this emphasis of the wall of white plaster. There's a massive description of that. And then there's a lampstand opposite, and you get the shadows cast by the lampstand. It's a spooky scene. And Belshazzar comes undone from head to toe when he sees it. And he, the scholars say, basically wet his pants. He's terrified. The text is telling us that in those terms. Even more so terrified because his wise men can't tell him what it's about. They can't tell him what it says. So verse 5, same verb used twice. To bring forth the vessels from the temple, now used of this spooky hand that brings forth this writing on the wall. The two things are related by the use of language, bringing out those vessels from the house of God, from the sacred place, putting them to non-sacred use. And now bringing out this hand. And there are the fingers of the hand, specifically mentioned, fingers of the hand. The hand is mentioned, but now verse 5, the fingers of the hand. Writing on the wall. Where else do you hear of fingers? It's a word not used that often, but you hear of it with the 10 plagues, when God judges the bad king, the Pharaoh of Egypt, who oppresses his people. You hear about it in the 10 commandments, the finger of God, laying down the law by which people will be judged. You hear it in the Psalms. Creation is the work of God's fingers. The fingers are God's presence for God's purpose. And look where they were writing. Opposite the lampstand. On the plaster of the wall of the palace of the king. This gets a bit detailed. Why all this description? Not the finger wrote on the wall, but all this. Why? We've been told something. You know, papyrus was expensive. People didn't waste words. But we're being told detail. Why? What's it about? The lampstand. Now we're told this lampstand's among the golden vessels taken from the temple in Jerusalem, right? The only one place where gold vessels were used in the temple was in the holy place. Not much furniture in there. Table of the presence with the showbread on it, the table of God's presence. The altar for incense. The worship of God. And the lampstand. The golden lampstand. in the temple in Jerusalem. God's gold vessels were being brought into a context where there is a lampstand, and the hand is writing opposite the lampstand, supposed to be suggesting God's presence and specifically his sanctuary. So there's this lampstand opposite the fingers, God's fingers. In the temple, this golden lampstand was opposite the table of the presence of God. Do you see? There we go. In terms of the writing on the wall, we're told about the fingers, God's presence. We're told about the lampstand, which in the temple, this lampstand was opposite the table of presence. And we're told about the palace in these verses. Now, there's a word repeated here in the Aramaic for palace, and the way it's used highlights when Neb took these temple vessels from God's house in Jerusalem, he shared them, the safe place, as it were. He put them in the safe place. He showed proper respect by putting them in his temple, recognizing they're special, putting them in the house of his God. But Belshazzar didn't treat them as special. Using them to drink at his party in his palace. He took them out of the sacred palace of God in Jerusalem. Okay, at least he put them in the sacred palace of his God, his deity in Babylon. But Belshazzar takes them out of there. And in doing so, he affronts and challenges God. Belshazzar took the vessels from God's house. So, God shows up at Belshazzar's house and puts the writing on the wall where his presence is on display. And in doing so, he affronts and challenges Belshazzar. Belshazzar took the vessels from God's house, so God shows up at Belshazzar's house to sort it out and takes control of the situation. And King Belshazzar is completely undone. And God shows us to proclaim that Belshazzar is finished, all these things, that leads to those temple vessels being returned and restored to the temple in Jerusalem by Belshazzar's successor, the Persian king. God's come to Belshazzar's rebellious house and he's overthrown it. That's what's happened. And after this writing goes on the wall, three speeches follow. Firstly, the queen comes in, verses 10 to 12. The king should have known about Daniel, but she comes in and says, you've got this guy, you can interpret this for you, because in him is the spirit of the holy gods. You'd think this should have been known by Daniel. His father's chief wise man is Daniel. Belshazzar should have known about Daniel. And the queen keeps repeating, your father, what's this about? Belshazzar knows exactly who Daniel is, but chooses not to. Because Belshazzar was so important to King Nebuchadnezzar, his father. He's trying to show himself more powerful than King Nebuchadnezzar. That's what I'm trying to get at. He's trying to alienate, and he's been marginalizing Daniel, and he's been shoving him out. Showing contempt to God's spokesman in Babylon. And the queen is keeping on. Your father. Remember the situation with your father. Remember what happened with your father. Remember what Daniel did for your father. Remember what happened then following that to your father. And you remember how he was restored, exactly as Daniel said. But Belshazzar wanted to push Daniel out, because he wasn't going to live in the shadow of great King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, he had to, because he wasn't a great king. So the queen comes in and speaks, and then Belshazzar speaks out in verses 13 to 16. When characters speak, they do so to reveal something about themselves in the ancient Near East. It's something to do with parchments and so on. It's something to do with how you characterize people, how you tell a story. It's a lot to do with characterization. And when Belshazzar speaks up, as Daniel appears in verses 13 to 16, he doesn't say, as the queen had said, are you my father's chief magician? He says, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah?" It's his constant obsession with his father. Belshazzar doesn't call him the chief musician. He puts Daniel down. And doesn't even acknowledge that Daniel's able to tell the interpretation. Doesn't call him the chief magician. Are you the captive brought back from exile? In exile. He doesn't even acknowledge Daniel's able to tell the interpretation. He doesn't seem to like Daniel very much. And this esteemed servant of God that Nebuchadnezzar had honoured, Belshazzar doesn't. Belshazzar hasn't honoured God's temple vessels from his presence in his temple in Jerusalem. And he now hasn't honoured the servant of God, but sought to debase and defame him too. And now Daniel speaks out in verses 70 to 28, and this is a long speech. The king has brought Daniel in there to tell him about the dream. And most of what Daniel says is not about the dream's interpretation, but its significance for Belshazzar. Daniel doesn't start with the interpretation. Verses 18 to 19, he tells the story of how God made Nebuchadnezzar great. It was God who made Nebuchadnezzar great. But, verse 20, "But when his heart became arrogant," that's when Nebuchadnezzar's heart became arrogant, "and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. And bad things happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Until," verse 21, "until he acknowledged that the Most High God is the sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes." Is that why King Belshazzar didn't like Daniel? In verses 22 to 24, "But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this." Specifically, verse 23, "Instead, you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven." How? "By bringing the temple vessels of Jerusalem, firstly, into your house. Secondly, to use them as common things, drinks and so on. And thirdly, by praising the false gods of Babylon, idols that cannot see, hear or understand. But you did not honour the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways," says verse 23. "Therefore," verse 24, "he sent the hand that wrote this inscription." Daniel gives that history lesson you should have known better because of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And then the lesson's applied to Belshazzar. You've gone and made the same foolish mistake with brass knobs on. Now, King Belshazzar didn't ask for any of that. He just asked for the interpretation. He's about to get it and he's not going to like it. But what Daniel has done is explain the significance of what's happened. And then comes the interpretation. The history lesson, you should have known better. The application of the indictment of Belshazzar. This is what you've done. You've made all the same mistakes with brass knobs on. Now here's the interpretation. "Therefore," verse 24, "God," the God who did all this for Nebuchadnezzar and who Nebuchadnezzar learned the lesson about, "he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. Mene, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, you've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians." Here's the conclusion. Belshazzar has disdained God, his temple vessels from his inner sanctuary, and God's servant and spokesman, his accredited, proven servant and spokesman, Daniel. He's disdained those. Nebuchadnezzar discovered all that stuff is wrong. The wrong thing to do. And Nebuchadnezzar therefore turned back to God and his kingdom was restored. You see, Belshazzar knew all this, but didn't humble himself, didn't learn the lesson of his father, didn't honour the God who gave him power and upheld his life. He was proud and he was blasphemous. And so the words of the vision are all to do with value, weight and coins and things like that. So the gold vessels of God's temple, his father's esteemed chief magician. He hadn't valued the God his father had learned to value and exalt. So verses 29 to 31, for this act of rebellion against God, manifested in his conduct and behavior, his bad rule as a bad king, when Nebuchadnezzar had become a great king, Belshazzar's power gets taken from him that very night. Babylon falls to the Medes, as prophesied in Isaiah. King Nebuchadnezzar had been a great king, made so by God, and credits God for that, but King Belshazzar is our first glimpse in the book of a blasphemous, defiant king who is judged by God. Later in the book come kings that'll make him look good, but that's in the later part of the book. And the point is this. Kings, those in leadership, those in authority, and all of us, do well to acknowledge God's control and power over our lives. Because we are all accountable to God, the great King. Even in times when we have kings and rulers who do not honour God, we do well to acknowledge God, his control, his power over our lives, because God is active in human history to raise up and, for his faithful people and for his glory, to take down proud, incorrigible, can't be corrected, blasphemous, and God-dishonouring rulers. Which is exactly the comfort given to believers under Roman rule in Revelation 14:8 and Revelation 18:2. Fallen is Babylon the Great. Fallen. Fallen. And in days when we find ourselves under pressure from those in authority, their authority is delegated, they're under the authority of the great king, who raises and brings down. That very night, Babylon fell. It's a reminder to us to entrust our way to the Lord. Trust him who stands behind human authority from the throne of heaven and holds us all accountable to him. And yes, there are days of hardship and difficulty for those who would be faithful to God, who are trying so to do and longing so to do much better. There ain't nobody gonna get away with nothing. And we can safely put our trust for the challenges we face in the God who is the ruler of the ends of the earth, who raises kings up and takes bad government down for its behavior, its arrogance, its pride, and its rebellion against the one true living God, against his presence, against his honour, against his faithful spokesmen and servants, for his glory and his people's relief. God bless you. Have a great day.